Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, July 31st, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group's telephone conference call on the Supreme Court's decision in Sackett versus Environmental Protection Agency. My name is Paul Zimmerman. I'm Publications Director here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome Professor Richard Frank of UC Davis School of Law and Mr. Damian Schiff, Senior Staff Attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation. Professor Frank is a professor of environmental practice and director of the California Environmental Law and Policy Center. Mr. Schiff has worked in a number of cases pertaining to the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act and was counsel for the petitioners in Sackett versus EPA. A more complete bio for the speakers was provided to you in the notice of the call, so I will stop here and reserve more time for their presentations followed by your questions. We're going to start with Mr. Schiff today. So, Mr. Schiff, please go ahead.
Thank you, and thank you to the Federalist Society for the opportunity to talk today about the Sackett decision. In my sort of brief opening remarks, I'd like to go over quickly the facts of the case, what happened in the lower courts, and then go right to the Supreme Court's decision, which was issued earlier this March, and talk about what that means for the Clean Water Act and maybe administrative law in general. As far as the facts go, PLF represents Mike and Chantel Sackett, an Idaho couple, who purchased about a half-acre residential lot within an existing residential subdivision in Priest Lake, Idaho, in 2005. After obtaining their local building permits from the county, the Sacketts started construction of their family home on that lot in the spring of 2007. But only a few days into construction, the Sackett's employees were met on the property by agents from the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers, who verbally ordered the Sackett's employees to stop the home construction on the grounds that they were illegally filling in wetlands without a Clean Water Act permit. After that meeting, the Sacketts asked EPA to provide them some sort of written explanation as to why the agencies thought they had control over their home building project, and that written response came in the form of a compliance order that was issued to the Sacketts in November of 2007. Now, under the Clean Water Act, the EPA has the authority, when it believes that the law has been violated, to issue a compliance order to the alleged violator. And this compliance order that the Sacketts received did a number of things. One, it informed the Sacketts that, in the view of EPA, the Sacketts had violated the law by not seeking a wetlands fill permit before beginning to construct their home. And secondly, the order immediately ordered the Sacketts to remove the fill that they had placed on the property and to restore the lot to its alleged pre-disturbance wetlands condition. And finally, the order threatened the Sacketts that if they did not immediately comply, they would be subject to a number of penalties and sanctions, including civil penalties of up to $32,500 per day. The Sacketts at that point, or shortly thereafter, came to PLF. We agreed to represent them. And we filed a lawsuit on their behalf in federal court in Idaho, challenging the compliance order on the grounds that it was issued without jurisdiction, that there are no wetlands on the Sackett's property, therefore they have no obligation to get a permit, therefore the compliance order is null and void. We also argued in the alternative that if, for some reason, the Sacketts could not get a hearing on that issue, that the compliance order would violate their due process rights. The district court dismissed our action, and the Ninth Circuit affirmed on the grounds that a compliance order is not the type of agency action for which a compliance order recipient can seek judicial review. The Ninth Circuit, in its opinion, interpreted the Clean Water Act as an implied decision on the part of Congress that these types of orders from EPA ought not to be reviewable because it would frustrate EPA's enforcement discretion and hamper its ability to administer the statute if it had to fear being hailed into court whenever it issued one of these orders. And the Ninth Circuit also reasoned that not being able to seek review immediately didn't violate the Sackett's due process rights for two reasons. One is that EPA could only collect fines accrued under the order if and when EPA chose to bring its own civil action in federal court. at which time the Sacketts would have an opportunity to defend themselves. And secondly, the court reasoned that, well, the Sacketts could have applied for a permit from the Army Corps, and if that permit had been denied, they could have then sued in federal court, arguing that they didn't need a permit to begin with because there are no wetlands on the property. We sought review in the Supreme Court, at which the court granted in June of last year, limited to two questions. One, do the Sacketts have a right to sue under the Administrative Procedure Act? And two, if not, does the compliance order violate the Sacketts' due process rights? The court issued its decision in March of this year, a unanimous decision authored by Justice Scalia, where the court answered the first question, yes, the Sacketts do have a right to judicial review under the APA, thus avoiding the second question about due process. The court looked at the statute and said the statute is silent, the Clean Water Act is silent as to the reviewability of compliance orders. There's a strong presumption in the law in favor of judicial review of agency action, and we, the court, discount EPA's intention that allowing judicial review is going to hamper its ability to administer the statute. Moreover, the court observed that the APA and its presumption in favor of judicial review are essentially a congressional rejection of the idea that administrative efficiency should trump the rights of the regulated public to seek review of actions that injure them. The court also ruled that the compliance order is a final agency action. The compliance order imposes its own liability, most prominently because of the fact that if you violate an order, you can be held liable for thousands of dollars in civil penalties. And secondly, the court found that the order was the end of the decision-making process, that there was nothing left for EPA or the Sacketts to do once that order was issued, except either to comply with the order or for EPA to bring a civil action in federal court to enforce the order, that there was nothing else to be done, that the terms of the order were basically set in stone. The decision also, though unanimous, won invited two concurrences. Justice Ginsburg concurred on the grounds that she thought that the court was simply holding that landowners can challenge a compliance order if they are contesting the jurisdiction of the agency to issue the order, but she was reserving judgment as to whether a landowner could challenge an order simply on the grounds that he objected to various terms within the order, but not the agency's jurisdiction to issue the order. Justice Alito also concurred, basically to continue to excoriate the agency for what he thought to be exceedingly improper treatment of the Sacketts and other landowners through this compliance order process, and essentially urging Congress to legislatively fix the problem. The problem, as he sees it, being ultimately not so much a matter of judicial review, but rather of underlying confusion about the underlying jurisdiction of the agencies. What does waters of the United States mean? What areas can be regulated under the Clean Water Act? And Justice Alito, of course, expressed frustration that this is not the first time that the agencies have been castigated for not clarifying their jurisdiction, most recently in 2006 in Rapanos versus United States. The court basically said just that. And yet since 2006, neither the EPA nor the Corps has offered to produce new regulations. So that was a bit of a peek, I think, from Justice Alito, and may indicate that the court is thinking about taking up another Rapanos-type case in the future if the agencies don't act first. The decision, of course, means that compliance orders are judicially reviewable. What else does it mean? Well, it may mean that other actions taken under the Clean Water Act are now reviewable as well. For example, the Army Corps issues what are called jurisdictional determinations that say that the Corps has or has not authority over a given site. Lower courts before Sackett had held generally that those are not reviewable. It's arguable that Sackett may change that rule. Also, the Army Corps issues cease and desist orders, which are sort of the analog to EPA's compliance orders. Same thing there. Before Sackett, those were generally held to be unreviewable. That may change. As far as Sackett's application to other areas of administrative law, I think it really depends on a statute-by-statute basis. You really can't extrapolate any grand themes from Sackett other than the fact that the court continues to emphasize the strong presumption in favor of judicial review. And I think the fact that the Sackett decision was unanimous shows that whether it's a conservative or liberal underlying issue, if you want to put it that way, that ultimately the court is in full agreement that if individuals are being injured by agency action, the agency has a significant burden to carry if it wants to keep those folks out of federal court. That concludes my general introduction to the case, and I'll hand it back over to Paul.
Thanks very much, Mr. Schiff. Professor Frank, the floor is yours if you'd like to make some remarks, please.
Thank you, and I'd like to join Damian in thanking the Federalist Society for the opportunity to talk about this important case. And I do think that the Sackett decision was the most significant environmental case decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in the just-concluded term, one that involved actually three environmental law cases. And it's a fascinating case and decision, I think, because it really sits on the cusp of environmental law, administrative law, and constitutional law. Let me try and put the Sackett case into a somewhat larger context here. The case really derives from or finds its source in the jurisdictional limits of the Federal Clean Water Act, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary, having been enacted by Congress in basically its present form back in 1972. And since the statute was enacted, there has been some considerable controversy and a lot of litigation over the scope of federal jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act, which proscribes the discharge of pollutants into the navigable waters, or concurrently defined as waters of the United States, without a federal permit. The U.S. Supreme Court has now addressed that issue on four occasions. Back in 1985, in a decision called Riverside Bayview Home, the U.S. Supreme Court gave the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act an expansive reading. But more recently, the court has gone in the opposite direction, and all three of the most recent cases, including Sackett, have involved perhaps the most controversial aspect of the Clean Water Act regulatory program, the so-called dredge and fill program under Section 404, which limits the dredging and filling of wetlands. And beginning in 2001, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Solid Waste Agency of Northern Cook County, rejected and invalidated an expansive effort by federal regulators to impose wetlands permit jurisdiction over so-called isolated wetlands. In 2006, in a case called Rapanos versus United States out of Michigan, the court further narrowed the federal government's jurisdiction to control and limit the development of wetlands, although importantly, I think, the court was unable to arrive at a consensus view of the ground on which it was basing its decision. And as a result of that Rapanos decision for the last 6 years, I think it's fair to say that there has been a great deal of uncertainty over the scope of federal permit jurisdiction over wetlands. And I think that uncertainty and that really provides part of the predicate or foundation for the Sackett case. The second bit of foundational information I'd like to share involves the enforcement tools available to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in environmental cases. The federal regulators in appropriate cases can file a criminal enforcement action, formally prosecute members of the regulated community in federal court for criminal violations of the Clean Water Act. It similarly can go to court and pursue civil remedies, fines, and penalties against perceived violators of the Clean Water Act. And alternatively, it can pursue administrative enforcement options, such as were pursued in the Sackett case. And even there, the federal regulators, EPA, has a number of tools in the quiver. It can issue so-called notices of violation, which are simply letters advising members of the regulated community that according to the U.S. EPA, believes that they have violated the provisions of the Clean Water Act. Alternatively, EPA can issue more formal administrative compliance orders of the type that the Sacketts received here. And third and finally, the U.S. EPA can convene formal administrative hearings with an administrative law judge, which is an option not pursued in this case. Damian, I think, has done a good job of outlining the procedural history of the case. I think the Ninth Circuit decision in favor of EPA and against the Sacketts was, in a sense, unsurprising, because in that case, in the Sackett case, the Ninth Circuit joined five other federal circuit courts of appeal in holding that folks who have received administrative compliance orders like the Sacketts are not entitled to pre-enforcement judicial review, and no court in the country had held to the contrary. So it was therefore somewhat surprising, in light of that unanimity of opinion of the lower courts, that the Supreme Court granted review in the case. And I think that's in part due to the compelling advocacy of Damien Schiff and his colleagues at the Pacific Legal Foundation. When the case was argued before the Supreme Court, both in the written arguments and in the oral arguments, I thought the contrast was really striking. Sacketts, represented by the Pacific Legal Foundation, really cast this as a David versus Goliath type struggle, where the Sacketts were really stuck in a Kafkaesque type of dilemma, either spending a lot of money to restore the property to its original condition, even though they thought the property is not wetlands, or alternatively to risk the rather substantial fines threatened by US EPA into the future. The federal government defending the case in the Supreme Court took a very different approach. They really didn't talk about the importance to federal policy and the environment of the wetlands policy, and didn't talk about the property here and the lake environment. The federal government's arguments really read like a rather dry administrative law treatise. I thought it was also interesting that the Sacketts drew a lot of support from amici from around the country, friends of the court, business groups, a coalition of states, and others. Conversely, the federal government got precious little support from the environmental community or others. There was only one brief filed on its side. In the oral argument in this case that was held last January, again, it was an interesting juxtaposition. I thought Damien Schiff did an excellent job arguing before the Supreme Court. And while he received a spirited reception, as most advocates do in the Supreme Court these days, he fared much better than the Deputy Solicitor General, who was arguing in front of the justices, who began with the concession that the maximum applicable penalties that the Sacketts would face as a result under this administrative compliance order were actually twice as much as had previously been understood by the justices, and amounted to some $75,000 a day. And I think the oral argument from the standpoint of the federal government went downhill from there. Virtually all of the justices, not just the so-called conservative wing, but justices from across the ideological spectrum, I think were demonstrably hostile to the federal government's position. The other thing that became clear quickly in oral argument is that while the court had originally invited arguments on the question of both whether the Sacketts were entitled to pre-enforcement judicial review of the wetlands determination under the Administrative Procedure Act, and also had invited review of the underlying or the backstop constitutional question, whether a failure to provide judicial review would violate the Sacketts' due process rights, the justices at oral argument made it clear pretty quickly that they had no interest in addressing the constitutional issue, the due process issue, and were content to focus on the statutory issues as the decision itself did. And I think I don't have much to add with respect to the decision, the unanimous decision issued by the Supreme Court, other than to say that Justice Scalia, who wrote the majority opinion, was remarkably tempered in his remarks. It was left to Justice Alito, in the concurring opinion that Damien has already described, to excoriate the federal regulators for what he perceived as regulatory overreaching and harassment of private citizens. But also to bring this matter, this discussion full circle, to urge Congress to address and clarify the scope of wetlands jurisdiction that federal government, federal regulators have or don't have under the Clean Water Act. And in that regard, I don't often agree with Justice Alito, but I think that point is correct and one that folks on all points on the ideological spectrum would agree with, that as a result of recent federal court decisions, the scope of federal wetlands jurisdiction under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act is really a muddle. and the Congress has refused or declined to address and clarify that situation. And similarly, presidential administrations of both parties going back for the last 20 years have similarly declined to step up. And I think that has really provided for an untenable situation for landowners, environmental interests, and on the line regulators with respect to the wetlands jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act. The final point I just want to say is I think Damien Schiff and the Pacific Legal Foundation really did an outstanding job in selecting this case and getting it to the Supreme Court and achieving the result that they were seeking. They did a very effective job of advocacy both in their written arguments and in oral arguments before the court earlier this year.
Thanks very much, Professor Frank. And now I'd just like to give Mr. Schiff a chance to respond to anything that he heard in those remarks, especially just focusing on what this decision means going forward. So, Mr. Schiff, please go ahead.
Well, I would certainly agree with Professor Frank with respect to the approach that EPA took in litigating this case. For one thing, EPA really emphasized in the Supreme Court the argument that the compliance order was not final agency action. In retrospect, I think that was a significant strategic or tactical error, however you want to describe it, on the part of the agency. For one, because I think the argument is such a bad argument. In fact, it was one that the Ninth Circuit refused to address in its decision, instead resting its decision on the grounds that judicial review was affirmatively precluded by the Clean Water Act. And I think it was a bad argument because EPA was really trying to have it both ways. EPA was trying to argue that, well, this compliance order does have legal effect because if you violate it, you will be liable for these fines. But in practice, landowners can ignore it because the agency very rarely will seek a large amount of civil penalty for violating a compliance order. And I think that argument simply was rather unconvincing. I also think it was a mistake for EPA to argue so much on final agency action because it didn't really need to win on that point in order to win the whole case. As I mentioned, the Ninth Circuit ruled in favor of EPA just on the grounds of preclusion, and that would have been enough, of course, in the Supreme Court, at least on the APA question. I do want to mention, too, Professor Frank referenced this, the imbalance in the amici. We certainly tried, once the case was granted for review, we certainly tried our best to assemble a large coalition of amici, in not just private property rights groups, but also local governments, states, other entities that have been frustrated by EPA's enforcement pattern and the inability to have the opportunity to sue when a compliance order is issued. And I do believe that the imbalance in the amici had an impact on the court's decision-making. We've received, I believe, over a dozen amicus briefs in support of the Sacketts, and those amicus briefs were filed on behalf of, I believe, almost 50 organizations and governments, whereas EPA received one brief on behalf of the NRDC and three or four Idaho environmental groups. And so I think that imbalance had an impact on the court's decision-making. Finally, I think that Professor Frank is right that EPA's approach to this case was a little erudite and scholarly, a little maybe too scholarly for the agency's own good, because perhaps if the agency had played up more the importance of wetlands protection or had played up more the importance of having the ability to issue these orders without fear of being sued, perhaps the vote would have been different. It probably, I think, would have come out the same way in terms of the disposition, but maybe there would have been a solicitous dissent written for the agency. As it stands now, of course, there is none. Now, one point I wanted to mention before we go to questions is how EPA is going to implement this decision. In May of this year, there was a bit of a brouhaha created when a senior EPA official speaking at a wetlands conference stated that, in his view, Sackett won't really change the agency's enforcement practice, that it's same old, same old. And that comment stirred up the ire of a number of senators on the Public Works and Environment Committee. leading to a letter that was written in late May of this year to EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson, asking her to explain whether she approves of those comments or whether she does think that there's going to be a material change in EPA's enforcement practice. We haven't received a response yet to that, but it is interesting because, of course, in litigating Sackett, the agency took the position that, yes, if there is judicial review, that is going to change our enforcement practice, and that's one reason why, court, you should not allow folks to sue. Of course, arguing that it's same old, after the decision is, I think, in some tension with that litigation position that, that judicial review would have an impact. So whether Administrator Jackson ever responds to that letter, it certainly is interesting to see, to track if EPA will end up issuing fewer orders, if, in fact, the number of compliance orders that EPA will issue in the future will track what EPA has done in the past.
Professor Frank, your thoughts?
Well, let me just make three brief comments. I think Justice Scalia, in terms of addressing the EPA argument that this administrative compliance was order was really nothing more than the initiation of a dialogue with the Sacketts, he and the court really took a functional approach. They looked at the text of the administrative compliance order, which was very direct and in terms of the categorical statements that the Sacketts were in violation and that if they failed to remediate the property, they would be subject to these cascading daily fines. Justice Scalia and the court basically said if it walks, talks, and quacks like a final order, we, the reviewing courts, will treat it as such. And so I think Damien is correct. The EPA, in a sense, was trying to have it both ways in its interpretation of the administrative compliance order. The second interesting thing is that another one of the things that was surprising about the federal government's briefs on the merits, they really didn't take issue with the Pacific Legal Foundation's characterization of this as a David versus Goliath struggle between vast, unfeeling bureaucracy and the poor, unsuspecting Sacketts. The one amicus brief that was filed by the Natural Resources Defense Council on behalf of the Department of Justice and the EPA attempted to recast those facts and attempted to make the point that the Sacketts really were sophisticated landowners and that they ran an excavation company and that they were not babes in the woods, so to speak. When the Deputy Solicitor General tried to make that point in oral argument before the justices, he was summarily cut off by Chief Justice Roberts, who told him, if it's not in the record, I don't want to hear about it, or we don't want to hear about it, and then that was it. With respect to where do we go from here, I think EPA perhaps was a little tone deaf in that presentation that it's the same old, but as I mentioned, there are a number of administrative enforcement tools that I think remain available to US EPA. One is notice of violations, which is the single most frequently used enforcement tool administratively, and it seems to me that under both the Clean Water Act, under other environmental statutes, US EPA is free to issue those, and that those are unlikely to be found subject to immediate pre-enforcement judicial review, but notices of violation are far less draconian in their terms and impact than administrative compliance orders of the type challenged in this litigation.
Okay, thanks to both of you. I'm now going to open the floor to the audience questions, so we're going to go to the first question here.
Hi, my name is Lee Joseph. There were a couple of amicus briefs that addressed the idea that to bar judicial review post, I think it's 1966 when the relevant APA section was added, that's 5 U.S.C. 559, that it needed to be expressed. And the opinion, you didn't take that position, Mr. Schiff, I don't think. And the opinion sort of talks about implied preemption of review. And I would have much rather had sort of a reinforcement of the Section 559 post, I think it's 1966, Congress needs to be expressed. And I guess my question is, do you think the decision forecloses someone making that argument in a future case where there's a good case for implied preemption, a better case than the government had here, but there's no case for express preemption or preclusion of review?
Well, I think it's an excellent point. I mean, certainly there does seem to be some tension between this provision of the APA that precludes amendment of the statute unless it's expressly done so, and the doctrine of preclusion that has developed in the Supreme Court that allows Congress, or at least allows the court to find that Congress impliedly wanted APA review to be precluded without having a statement expressly so. I don't believe, though, that the Sackett decision, as strong as it is in terms of shoring up the presumption in favor of judicial review of final agency action, I don't believe that it will preclude the argument from being made by the government in the future, because I think what one could argue is that an implied preclusion doctrine is consistent with 5 U.S.C. 701 that says that the APA applies except where precluded by statute. And so saying that something is precluded by statute, whether impliedly or expressly, one could argue is arguably consistent with the APA itself, which certainly on its face anticipates some type of preclusion of review. Now, whether that preclusion would be limited to an express statement in a statute saying the APA doesn't apply, or whether it would be it would also encompass both an express and an implied preclusion, that's where the rub is. But I think that there is that argument to be made that preclusion, implied preclusion, is still consistent with the APA.
Professor Frank, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I have nothing to add.
Okay. Does the caller have a follow-up question or anything like that?
Well, I mean, is it true that you all, PLF, didn't raise that it needs to be press argument because the Clean Air Act was written after 1966?
Well, it was a point that we made very briefly in our opening merits brief, but we did not place a lot of reliance on it. We really, I think, relied more upon the general presumption in favor of judicial review.
Of course, yeah, sure. Thank you very much.
We're going to move on to the next question here.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Is the government's theory that they have jurisdiction because wetlands drain into navigable U.S. waters and pollute them, regardless of how much filtering might occur for the water in passage to that point? And if the agency is not going to change its practices, merely moving on to the next victim, then does it not seem appropriate to seek an injunction against the agency not to enforce its powers unless and until, for any given area in which it seeks to enforce them, it has published a map showing the exact boundaries of what particular parcels and boundaries of those parcels it claims jurisdiction, and do so in at least a year in advance of enforcement?
First of all, in terms of the Sackett's problem, we don't really know what EPA's assertion of jurisdiction is, because the compliance order doesn't go into a discussion of that, and we haven't received the administrative record, or the administrative record, I should say, hasn't been filed in federal court yet, because we only just got our right to a hearing. So that's more speculative. But I think in general, EPA would argue that it has jurisdiction over wetlands that do have a demonstrated and, technically speaking, a significant impact on traditional navigable waters. So that a wetland that is part of either by itself or part of a larger group of wetlands that do perform meaningful and measurable pollutant trapping functions or flood synchronization functions or any of the other functions and values that one associates with wetlands, that then those would be jurisdictional wetlands. As far as an injunction against the agency, certainly until we know whether EPA is going to really internalize the Sackett decision, I think that would be premature. I think also there would be significant procedural obstacles about how such a lawsuit would be brought, whether the plaintiffs would have standing to assert a claim against EPA if the plaintiff himself is not the one who is being threatened, but rather he's advancing a claim on behalf of of other individuals in the country who have been or may be injured by an EPA assertion of authority. So that's significantly more challenging to answer, but at least as far as jurisdiction goes, the impacts do play a major role in deciding whether EPA has statutory authority over any given set of wetlands.
Well, the point of my question is that they seem to have found their jurisdiction before anybody else could have reasonably anticipated that they would, for lack of some sort of public notice of the boundaries of that jurisdiction. So if anyone in the future is subject to similar enforcement, the obvious course of action would be to demand that they show jurisdiction and also that they have given advance public notice of it, so people aren't just hit with it by surprise.
Either of the speakers like to respond? Mr. Schiff?
I would just simply say that I think certainly, frankly, the regulated public as well as the agencies would like to have that degree of certainty. And there is a National Wetlands Inventory map, but that's compiled by the Fish and Wildlife Service and is not particularly accurate, and the agencies, the EPA and the Army Corps, don't really feel bound by that. And that's really the closest thing that I'm aware of that a landowner could look to determine whether he has wetlands. And, you know, one could argue that at some point we do have a vagueness issue, a due process vagueness issue, and in fact one of the alternative claims in the Sackett's complaint was a vagueness claim, that the compliance order's assertion of jurisdiction is based upon standards that a reasonable person of normal intelligence could not ascertain and therefore would be void. And so I do think there is some merit to the idea, and that just again underscores what both I and Professor Frank have mentioned with respect to the Sackett decision, Justice Alito's concurrence, the Rapanos decision, that really there has to be clarification, and if it's not going to come from the agencies or the Congress, then I suspect it will have to come from the court in the subsequent case.
This is Professor Fink. The only thing I would add is that, yes, that since the Rapanos decision that I mentioned in 2006, federal regulators have largely seized upon Justice Kennedy's concurring opinion, which is kind of interesting because of nine justices, he was only writing for himself as a concurring justice, he is the one who coined this idea of a significant nexus to navigable waters as being the regulatory predicate for wetlands jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act. So that presumably is what the U.S. EPA was relying on the Sackett case, as it is in most wetlands assertions of wetlands jurisdiction around the country. The other interesting thing that came out of the oral argument was that the Deputy Solicitor General, at one point in the argument, let slip that if one of these wetlands dispute was actually going to court, the federal regulators would probably work up a better and more definitive case on the jurisdictional issue than they would at the administrative stage, and that caused a number of the justices to noticeably blanch, and that was not terribly well received. I think the result of the Sackett decision is that if the U.S. EPA or the Corps decides to issue administrative compliance orders or other similar administrative enforcement efforts in the past, it's going to force them to be a bit more clear and have their geophysical ducks in a row, their scientific evidence, hydrological evidence set up and established to support their conclusion or their claim that the particular property in question has a significant nexus to a navigable water body of water such as Priest Lake, which was near the Sackett property in northern Idaho.
Well, we do have time for a few more questions here. I want to announce that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is going to be tomorrow, August 1st at 1 p.m. Eastern. And during that call, we are going to host a discussion on spectrum policy in the age of a spectrum crunch. And I invite you to consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum conference calls at the Teleforum page of the Federalist Society's website, and to visit our podcast page, which includes podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum conference calls. On to the next question.
This is Jack Park. Just a quick question. Excuse me. The court has granted cert in three cases this term involving the Clean Water Act and some particular applications of it. Do you think that any of the clarity that's not present from Rapanos will come out of these three cases?
Well, this is Professor Frank. I think the short answer to your question is no, because the Clean Water Act cases the court has taken involve parts of the Clean Water Act distinct from the wetlands provisions that were at issue in Sackett. So while those cases raise important questions about the scope of the Clean Water Act as it relates in one case to the logging-related runoff and the other to flood control channels, I don't think it's going to clarify the jurisdictional muddle that currently exists with respect to wetlands jurisdiction under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act, which was the focus of the Sackett case.
I had a quick question as we're kind of drawing to a close here. I just wanted to see if the speakers would like to talk a little bit more, and I know we covered it some, about the questions that went unresolved in this case and any future litigation that is currently going on, of which the speakers are aware, that will be affected by this case or litigation that might be brought after this case. Mr. Schiff, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, with respect to what the Supreme Court didn't address in the Sackett decision, the due process question, that leaves open for another day an incredibly important issue of due process as applied to the Superfund law, to CERCLA. The law is fairly clear under CERCLA that if you receive a unilateral compliance order from EPA, you really have no right to sue immediately over that compliance order, and instead you have to basically clean up the site and then seek reimbursement for your cleanup costs if you think that you were not a responsible party. Just before the Sackett case was accepted for review in the Supreme Court, the court was considering whether to grant review in a case out of the D.C. Circuit called General Electric v. Jackson. And that case brought by General Electric raised the question of whether the prohibition on so-called pre-enforcement review of CERCLA compliance orders violates the due process rights of the compliance order's recipient. And GE argued that, in fact, the compliance order that it had received had violated its due process rights, had decreased the value of its stock, had caused other damages to the company, and that violated its due process rights. The Supreme Court denied cert in that case shortly thereafter, granted cert in the Sackett's case. And so... at least I think at that time it showed that the court was not particularly interested in addressing due process, and as we now know, the court chose not to address it in Sackett. Notwithstanding that, the fact that one of the amicus briefs filed on behalf of the Sacketts was from GE, urging the court to reach the due process question and to hold that compliance orders violate due process when one does not have the right to an immediate hearing. So ultimately, I think the court should and I hope will address that question, but it's not going to happen, I think, anytime soon. As far as cases, important cases, I know of at least two cases already filed this past spring in federal district courts that have been enabled by Sackett. One case in the District of Colorado contesting EPA's assertion of jurisdiction over a natural gas mining operation, and another case in the District of West Virginia where EPA is contending that a poultry farm needs to get a stormwater permit under the Clean Water Act stormwater provisions. Both of those cases concerned just compliance orders and therefore have been enabled by the Sackett decision, and I'm sure that there are other cases either pending or soon to be filed that will also have been enabled because of Sackett's green light to lawsuits based on compliance orders.
And Professor Frank, your thoughts?
Well, I agree that the due process issue, which the Supreme Court did not address in Sackett, is the next big looming issue. In a sense, the Clean Water Act was the best case for the Sacketts because the Clean Water Act doesn't address explicitly the particular issue of whether pre-enforcement judicial review is available in enforcement proceedings brought under the Clean Water Act, whereas under CERCLA, the Superfund law, Congress was explicit in saying under the Administrative Procedures Act and under CERCLA, there is no right to pre-enforcement judicial review. So that puts the constitutional issue up front and center. And I think at some point, the federal courts and probably the Supreme Court is going to be asked to address that underlying constitutional issue of whether due process requires a pre-enforcement judicial hearing to a member of the regulated community, regardless of what Congress has chosen to say. Damian talked about the GE case, which involves CERCLA, and the fact that the Supreme Court denied review just before it granted review in the Sackett case. And ironically, it seems to me that was probably the best thing that could have happened to the Sacketts and to their counsel, because the GE case provides much less attractive facts from the standpoint of the property rights movement and the regulated community than did the Sacketts. For a well-heeled firm like GE, the fact of these accruing monetary fines is just a cost of doing business and is not going to be a huge financial sacrifice. But as we both discussed, the Sacketts being individual, a couple, married couple, individual landowners, a far more attractive set of facts for those seeking to challenge the enforcement regime.
Thank you both. And as we draw to a close here, I want to give both Mr. Schiff and Professor Frank a chance to just sum up their views on this case and the implications of this case for a few minutes. Mr. Schiff, do you have any remarks?
The only thing I'd like to mention is just sort of more of a commentary on the public interest law movement, because I, for those who aren't familiar with Pacific Legal Foundation, we are a nonprofit legal foundation, and so we represent our clients for free. We don't charge attorney's fees, and that is an important factor as to why the Sacketts could litigate this case, because the Sacketts purchased their lot for $23,000 back in 2005. Obviously, the cost of litigating a case from federal district court all the way up to the Supreme Court is a heck of a lot more than $23,000, and they would not have been able to do that were it not for us. And so this case, I think, is a good example of the public interest law movement being useful, not just because of the cost issue, but also because it shows that perseverance pays off. As Professor Frank mentioned, when the Ninth Circuit had ruled in this case, it was not writing into or issuing a decision into a vacuum. It was following what had been up to that time the unanimous decisions of the courts of appeals holding that compliance orders are not judicially reviewable. Notwithstanding that fact, the court did take up the case, and I think it shows that perseverance pays off. And it does also, as I say, show that public interest groups, not just on the right, but on the left also, obviously, do have an important role to play in shaping case law.
Professor Frank, your thoughts?
I very much agree, and I was going to make the same point, that public interest litigation on both the from both the left and the right, I think, are hugely important in terms of developing the law. I wish the federal courts were a little bit more receptive in terms of standing to sue and access to the courthouse of public interest litigation, whether it's generated from the Pacific Legal Foundation or the Institute for Justice on the one hand, or the Sierra Club and NRDC on the other.
Okay, well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both of our experts, Professor Frank and Mr. Schiff, today. Thank you also to our audience for joining us. We welcome your feedback by email to nfip@fedsoc.org. Please join us tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern for our call on spectrum policy, and we are adjourned. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.